And without any further ado, Robert and Joanna Titus are our speakers today, so I'll let them continue.
Well, you can sit down. For those of you who don't know us, we're both scientists. Have been all of our lives. Well, really, since we've been kids, we've just been discussing it with the youngest person in our audience today, that we really have been scientifically minded since we've been kids. We think that really we're great examples of adults who stimulated as kids to be curious about the world, found things that kept us interested and still keep us interested today. Robert teaches geology at Hartwick College. I teach biology at SUNY Dutchess. Both of us have devoted years to doing professional scientific research, but now we spend much of our time communicating our science to good people like you. We spend time exploring the Catskills and the Hudson Valley, looking for things to write about. We write a monthly column for Woodstock Times. We write a weekly column for the six newspapers of the Columbia Green Media Group. The now in trouble Daily Mail is the closest one around here. And that comes out on Thursdays. And we also write quarterly articles for Catskill Life magazine. Now we usually, at this point, say, who's come the farthest today to get here? And where did you come from?
Outside of Worcester.
Ooh, it can be Worcester's farm.
It can be Worcester.
Looks like we have a winner.
Okay. There we go. Oh, you said you found it on the internet?
Yep.
Okay. That's great.
I couldn't. How do you do it?
Okay. And we also occasionally write a book. The most recent one that we've written is The Hudson Valley and the Ice Age. That's the one we're going to talk about today. And we're currently working on a new expanded edition of the Catskills, A Geological Guide. And we hope that's out in late spring. We work with many nonprofit organizations, historical societies, of course, libraries, hiking groups, speaking at places like the John Burroughs Society, Thomas Cole National Historic Site, ALANA, Albany Institute of History and Art, and even a presidential library. Connecting the culture, the art, and even the industry of the area to its prehistoric heritage, its geology. Altogether, we do between 20 and 40 public presentations a year, and in our talks, we like to entice our audience into using their imagination, their mind's eye, to see what we see when we look out onto a landscape. So the two of us tend to live really in three different worlds. Worlds not separated by space, but rather by time. Oh, and that's our news book. So the first world is the world of today, world that we see around us. We see the scenic beauty and we enjoy it just the same way that you do. But we see a second world, a world represented by the surrounding bedrock geology. The stratified layered rocks show us environments as they were. Time literally stacked upon itself for hundreds of millions of years. From those hundreds of millions of years ago, right up to last year's flood deposits, not even yet turned to rock.
Joanna, if I turn, because it's hard to see that, if I turn that, can you still see your notes?
Sure, I think. Yeah.
Okay.
We can read those local rocks, and we can let them take us, in our mind's eye, back to an ancient ocean called the Catskill Sea. It's populated by a rich and diverse seafloor ecology, preserved in the fossils that we observe and study, and that Donna brought us today. That time is the subject of the book that we're finishing up now. But then there's that third world, one that's also gone now, but so recently that its scars on the landscape are still visible. Those scars speak to us of the history of the Ice Age. The great vistas and landscapes painted by the Hudson River School of Art were sculpted by the passing of the ice. It's that third world we'd like to concentrate on, one that we want to take you to this afternoon. Few really appreciate how great the Ice Age was. At its zenith, some 28,000 years ago, only the peak of the mountain we know now as Slide Mountain, at 4,200 feet, might have poked its top out of the ice from here all the way back to the Adirondacks. And doing so, it's called a nunatak, which means in Eskimo languages, an island in a sea of ice. So here we stand in this space, but in a different time. If we go back to that time and use our mind's eye and look around us, all we see, up, down, side to side, everywhere we look, is solid ice for thousands of feet. These maps of North America, whoops, there's this, what Slide Mountain must have looked like. Sticking out on a sea of ice. These maps show North America when it was submerged by the Laurentide Ice Sheet. You'd have to visit Antarctica today to see anything like it. The ice expanded out of Labrador and swept south as far as Long Island. So right here, again, 20,000 years ago, nothing but ice. Then the climate began to warm. There were periods of warmth, but there were also periods where the cold returned. And when the cold returned, fingers of ice grew off of that gigantic ice sheet, what we call glaciers. And advanced and retreated and advanced and retreated in response to that fluctuating climate for quite a long time until the climate again stabilized.
Our book is kind of a tour guide to the GMA Ice Age history of the Hudson Valley. We're in each of the chapters going to take you to a different locality in the Hudson Valley. We'd like you to go to that site, and we illustrate the chapter and we describe what you're going to encounter. Perhaps you've been to the Gertrude's Nose Trail in the Gunks and the Shungunk Mountains, and we did several years ago getting ready for the book, and it was early in the morning, the sun was just coming up, and we were climbing up the Blue Trail, and part of the trail was bedrock, and we saw this, and the sun shined down just right. And I took a picture, and it was just perfect for the book. The rock is so shiny. Isn't that peculiar? Isn't that strange? How did it get shiny? And on top of that, it's got striations, scratches in it, from the lower left to the upper right. And where did they come from? How did they get to be where they are today? Oops. That's a little better. Where's the, oh, I know. There are the striations. It looked as if something had crossed that surface of rock a long time ago, a long time before we reached it. And we knew it right away. We know what we're looking at. We were following in the trail of a glacier. Ahead of us, probably about 25,000 years ahead of us, a glacier had ground its way up that slope on the Blue Trail and carried with it sand at the bottom and cobbles and boulders at the bottom. And the sand polished that rock, made it shiny, and the boulders crossing that surface dragged bottom and created the scratches that you see there. We're in the very footsteps, the very path of a glacier. What an experience that is. And that's what our book is all about, taking you out to see places where you can go and to see the Ice Age history that is to be found there. Here's another Ice Age structure right there. You'll see a series of crescent shape marks. They're called chatter marks. Here's three, which are a little clearer to look at. How did they get there? It's so easy to walk by something like this and not take any notice of it. You have to train your eye to see these things. The book is about training your eye and noticing things that you never would have seen before. This is the path of a boulder being carried by the ice as it was dragged across that surface. The boulder is pressed down by the weight of the ice and pressed forward by the push of the ice. It presses down and it's stuck and it's stuck and it's stuck, and then the push from behind causes it to leap forward, and it's pressed down and down and down until the push from behind causes it to leap forward. And every time it leaps forward, it creates one of those nicks in the surface, crescent-shaped nicks. You're looking in the direction that the ice flowed and in the direction that a boulder was dragged across that surface. And you learn to call that a chatter mark or a crescent mark. And it's just something that's there that you had never noticed before. And it conjures up an image of an advancing glacier. And you stand on the rock and hold your hands up in the air. And you feel the cold of the ice once exactly where you are. What an experience. When you get to the top, you reach Gertrude's Nose on the Blue Trail. It's a beautiful cliff with a great view of the Hudson Valley beyond. That's why people went there in the first place. That's why people go there today. We see the beautiful cliff just like anybody else, but we see the Ice Age as being the originator of that cliff. The glacier dragged past left to right, and as it passed across the top of that ledge of rock, it stuck to the rock. You remember maybe the Gene Shepherd story of the little boy who stuck his tongue to the parking meter in the middle of January in Hammond, Indiana, and he couldn't get his tongue off of the parking meter. The glaciers do that with rock. They stick their tongues onto the rock and they get stuck. So the glacier is moving across the top of the ridge. It's adhering to the rock. It's moving forward. Something's got to give. The glacier keeps persisting in its downstream motion. It yanks a great block of rock out of the ground. And that's how the cliff came into existence. Johanna and I will stand at a site like this, and we'll feel the glacier going by, and we'll hear the great cracking sound as that enormous block of rock has been ripped loose and dragged off and carried off down the valley, leaving a beautiful cliff behind. It's so much better to appreciate that beautiful cliff as an Ice Age feature than just a ooh and ah at it. It's more than just beautiful. It is a history right there in front of us. How far did the glaciers get? If you've spent much time in northern Long Island, you may remember that there's little hills in northern Long Island. They're composed of sand and gravel. This is how fast, how far the glacier came. The glacier reached North New Jersey, and it reached the middle of Long Island, and then it retreated, and it left behind a heap of earth. A glacier, an advancing glacier, is a bulldozing glacier. It's scraping up earth, pushing it forward, and leaving it where it got reached its maximum distance to the south. And it left behind something we call a moraine, in fact, a terminal moraine. Johanna and I are very familiar with the one in New Jersey, less familiar with the one in Long Island, but there it is. This is a diagrammatic view of a retreating glacier. That's the moraine, a heap of earth. There's the retreating ice. The landscape behind the retreating ice is very wet, pond and pond and pond and pond, lots of little streams flowing away from the melting ice, and all in all, it's a fairly flat landscape. There's a horizon of sand left behind by the retreating ice. We can look for things of that sort. Geologists are learned about identifying moraines. Geologists love to drive around, and every time they find a moraine, they like to plot it up on the map and link the X's they've drawn on the map together to draw a moraine. This is the terminal moraine of Long Island in New Jersey. The glacier retreated.
when it got warm, it advanced when it got cold, it retreated when it got warm, it advanced when it got cold, it retreated when it got warm, it advanced when it got cold. And every advance left a recessional moraine. And lots of them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 in this map view. What a lot of fun it is to drive around, identify moraines, plot them up on the map, and document the retreating history of the great Laurentide ice sheet as it was working, melting its way back to the north. Johanna and I know because we did a lot of this when we were working on the book. We explored Columbia County, and every time we found a moraine, we plotted it up on the map. And here's the best one that we could find. We're a little bit east of Red Hook on a highway called 199, and we were driving east, and Johanna said, "Look at that." And I looked at that, and we stopped, and we got out. And up on the northern horizon was a great series of little hills, all kind of glued together, up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. That was the moraine. We were looking north, and we saw the moraine, the Red Hook Moraine, it's called, for good reason. And in our mind's eye, here's where the mind's eye comes in again, we stood and we looked that direction, and we were transported back into time about 15,000 years. And rising above today's moraine was a glacier. It was a blue-gray glacier. It was fractured. It was broken. It had been very warm. This was a retreating glacier, and vast quantities of water were pouring out of fractures in the ice. And we were staring to the north, and we were looking at that glacier. Huge heaps of sand and gravel lay in front of that ice. And then the water is pouring out of those melting masses of my ice and sweeping up sand and carrying that sand south, which isn't very far, to create the flat plain before the moraine. We tested that. We always keep a shovel in the back of the car. I grabbed it, stuck it into the ground. And if it was your backyard, it wouldn't go very far before it would hit a rock, right? When you want to plant something, you hit rocks. Two rocks for every dirt, right? Yeah, not here. The shovel smoothly slipped into the sand of an outwash plain, it's called. South of every moraine is a sheet of sand with almost no rocks in it whatsoever. It's called an outwash plain. What a vivid experience it was for the two of us to stand here and look at that first world, the world of today, and then to be transported into that third world, the world which wears the scars of its geological history. And these are the scars of its ice age history. To be able to do that is the privilege of being a geologist. It's an exciting moments in our lives when we make these discoveries. We'll do several more in this talk. What does a moraine look like on the inside? Here and there, every once in a while, the highway folks come along and cut through a moraine, and we're so pleased when they do that. And when you see a moraine on the inside, you see very, very big boulders. They could only have been pushed to where they are by the advance of the ice. Water couldn't have carried them. Certainly wind didn't blow them around. A bulldozing glacier pushed that stuff to where it is. This is just off of Route 32, down by the old cowboy village.
Carson City.
Carson City, very close to Carson City. The highway cuts right through a moraine in that location. Here's another ho-hum feature. Well, it's just a pond, big deal, who cares, there's lots of ponds. We want you to get used to the idea that most ponds are of an ice age origin. This is a funny pond. The more you look at it, the more you think of it. It doesn't have a stream flowing into it, and it doesn't have a stream flowing out of it. It should have both, shouldn't it? Most ponds have flow of water in and out. This is just a hole in the ground, deep enough so the water table has created the pond. That's just a little off. That's just a little odd. You have to have a real awareness of landscape to notice that sort of thing, but that's the case. We look at this, and we see a great block of ice rising out of the ground in that location, a landlocked iceberg. When that glacier was melting, big fragments of it broke loose and were buried in the outwash sands. And they sat there for maybe a century or two before they could melt. It takes a long time to melt ice of this sort. And when those landlocked icebergs finally melted, there was a hole in the ground. It filled up with water. Almost all natural lakes in the Northeast are Ice Age in origin. So many other lakes are man-made. They have a dam. You don't pay much attention. But places like Bell Pond across the river, there's a beautiful Ice Age kettle pond, they're called. And you have to stand on its edge and you have to witness for yourself a great berg of ice rising out of the ground, a long ago melted berg of ice. Again, our lives are so much more interesting than most because we see these things wherever we go, and we're always transported into the past. Ditto these boulders. Who cares? It's just a boulder. Big deal. Who cares? It's just a miserable bunch of rocks lying there. They're called glacial erratics, and they were transported by the glacier. They were carried by the glaciers. Nothing else that can move a boulder that big. And when that glacier melted, the boulder didn't, and it was left behind. We would like you, from now on, anytime you see a boulder, to imagine and understand that it's almost certain that that boulder is where you see it because a glacier brought it to where you see it. If you have a very sophisticated understanding of bedrock geology, you'll be able to walk up to the boulder and identify it from where it came from. You might find it in here in Cairo, a boulder that came from the Adirondack Mountains. We have found them. You might find a boulder that came from the White Mountains. It was transported here by the advance of the glacier and left here when that glacier melted. And the rock matches the Adirondacks and it matches the White Mountains, but it is not native to Cairo. It just didn't come from here. It's an erratic because it's the wrong kind of rock for the location. Well, again, we just always see. We don't look and say, oh, look at the boulders. And we don't walk by them without not paying attention. We say, oh, look at the glacial erratics. There was a glacier here once. Again, how far did the glacier get? This is the terminal moraine in yellow in the New York City metropolitan area. And then the glacier melted, and it left that moraine behind. That moraine was a big heap of earth. You saw that at Red Hook. And it's perfectly plausible that it will fill up behind with meltwater from the retreating glacier. And a lake will form. This lake is called Lake Flushing. These are the palisades rising out of the lake. And on the other side is Lake Hackensack. Most of the New York City metropolitan area was glug, 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 underwater. When we look at the Statue of Liberty, we see Lady Liberty up to her waist in Lake Flushing. When we travel to the Jersey Meadows, we see those as the bottom of the lake, Lake Hackensack. That's the big football stadium out there. Next time you watch it on TV, remember that it's at the 50-yard line is right at the bottom of a glacial lake. What a thing to think. What a silly thing to think. It just happens to be true.
The stadium sunk a bit, too.
And then, yeah, well, she says it sank a little bit. Not surprising. The mud at the bottom of a lake is easy to sink through. Question?
Are there cypress tree stumps in the Meadowlands that were sheared? Existing cypress.
I can't imagine cypress.
I'm in that area.
It could be trees, yes. Yeah. I can't imagine they would be cypress.
Cypress.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I've heard of trees.
Trees, yes. Cypress, probably not. Yeah. It's not unusual. You can see stumps of trees that are that old. We have found them. Well, the glacier retreated up the Hudson Valley, and it left behind a big lake, Glacial Lake Albany, which in the city of Albany, it's very, well, the bottom of Albany is flat, isn't it? You drive, next time you're in Albany, we want you to notice that the streets are all flat. You don't look uphill, you don't look downhill. Most of the city is flat. You're in the bottom of a lake. You're in the bottom of Lake Albany. Pull over, get out, look up 60 feet above you. We can see the wind blowing waves past us. We look towards the sun, and the sunlight captures the waves as they blow by us. And they're 60 feet up there. What an experience. What a hoot. What a rearrangement of reality What a journey into the past. What does it look like? It's pretty darn boring. The next time you're on the thruway, north of Kingston and all the way up to Catskill, we want you to notice how left and right there's so much flat. Well, ho-hum. That's not scenery, is it? That's not the Grand Canyon. That's just as flat as could be. We were driving north on the thruway, and Johanna said, look, and we pulled over, and I got my shovel out, and I ran off into the field, and I pushed that shovel easily into the ground. There were no two rocks for every dirt there. It was all lake bottom muds. This was the bottom of a lake, and we both got out, and we gazed up 60 feet, our jaws dropping in astonishment. We stood on the bottom of a lake. Geology's fun, isn't it? Yeah. Have Mom take you out fossil hunting sometime. And so many of the landmarks in the Hudson Valley are built on the floor of Lake Albany. This is Montgomery Place in a Livingston home on the east shore of the Hudson River. Magnificent, ancient house with an enormous history, a history far older and far more distant than most people recognize. That beautiful front lawn, flat as can be, with a circular driveway. How many great carriages rolled up to that house, and beautifully dressed, very wealthy people got out for social events. None of them realizing that they were standing on the bottom of a lake, and that the flat there made a beautiful front yard for a great mansion and a great circular driveway. Circular driveways are make you an important person. Yeah. Yes, you'll just caught my attention now. Yep. That's the bottom of a lake, and the lake was deep enough so all of the house was underwater. You see how our lives are different from yours? We go places, we see such marvelous things. If you ever get a chance, there'll be places where the lake deposits have been exposed. This is on the Esopus Creek Preserve in Saugerties. And they had a landslide, and it opened up some of the sediment. We got a picture. And those are lake bottom deposits. Those are stratified clays. How exciting it is to us to actually see the clays, because we don't very often get to see them. They're usually buried. But there they are. So much of our landscape was created by the Ice Age. This is Schenectady in Rotterdam. And it was built upon the delta when the Mohawk River flowed into Lake Albany. Well, it carried sediment, deposited a delta. Subsequently, much later in time, the lake drained and the delta was left behind. And it was a wonderful place to build houses. And somebody came along and said, I'm going to put my house here. I can dig a basement. I won't have to worry about it flooding. The ground is beautifully well drained. It's nice and dry. The landscape is flat. I can dig all I want in it. There are no rocks here. And then a second house was built, and a third, and a fourth, and a fifth. And Schenectady came into existence. General Electric came along and said, oh, this is a wonderful place. And so too Rotterdam. Almost nobody there understands, they should. Almost nobody there understands that their city is built upon a delta. A delta in glacial Lake Albany. What a hoot. This is what a delta looks like. If you had a good high school earth science course, you learned that deltas have what are called foreset beds. They're inclined towards the lake, overlain by topset beds, stratified rocks that are sediments that are horizontal. This is a sand pit that cut right into the Elisaville Delta down in the village of Elisaville, a little village built upon a small delta, the way Schenectady is built upon a big delta. And again, this is one of those things. We look at this and we see the sediments and we understand that we're looking at a delta, and it transports us into that third world. They're built upon another delta is the Vanderbilt Mansion in Hyde Park. Again, the next time you go to Hyde Park, we'd like you to notice that the whole town is flat as can be.
It's built on the top of a delta, and the top of a delta is flat. Anywhere in Hyde Park, you stick a shovel into the ground. Johanna's going to tell you about putting shovels in the ground there. It'll smoothly and easily go into the ground. There's no rocks to get in your way. You're standing on the Hyde Park Delta. How many people know that? Well, all the ones who didn't buy our book. This you'll recognize as the Franklin Roosevelt home, or the Roosevelt home. And a delta has a top set, which is flat, a fore set, which is steeply sloping. The water, when it was Lake Albany was there, came up to about here. And the Roosevelts came along and said, this would be a nice place to build a house. We're going to have a view of the Hudson River. And we can dig a basement. There's no problem. It's easy to dig here. And all of our grounds will be flat. And we can cut driveways and plant trees and walk all over our own property. It will always be flat. And they probably, not a one of them knew that they were on top of a delta. I wonder if Franklin even knew that he was on top of a delta. Well, we come along and we see the Roosevelt House and we see it planted right on the edge of a delta. Well, the glaciers melted and vast quantities of meltwater poured off of them, and there's erosive flows of rock. The biggest thing that we know about that they eroded was Catterskill Clove. Wow, how did it get there? You've been up the Clove, haven't you? It's a beautiful place. It's a steep-walled canyon, and you take the highway up, and a geologist realizes all that space used to be filled with rock. And it was vacated when Catterskill Creek eroded into that rock and created the canyon. Where did all that stuff go? The rock was turned into sand, and the sand deposited Palinville. You see the big fan of sediment at the bottom of the Clove? That stuff used to be rock. It was turned into sand. It was carried downhill. It was deposited in what we call Palinville today. What an image we can conjure up. We still see glaciers up here, and we see raging, foaming, pounding, thundering white water torrents cascading down the canyon, raising a racket that almost hurts your hearing at the peak of its flow at the end of the Ice Age. This is a beautiful place to begin with, but we, in our mind's eye, make it so much more interesting. This is the Red Chasm at the bottom of the canyon. I'll bet a lot of you, some of you have been there. Yeah, some of you haven't, I'll bet. It's worth the journey. And it's just as steep a canyon as you can imagine. The walls are virtually vertical. We want you to fill all of that up with raging, foaming, pounding, thundering white water torrents, making an enormous racket and cutting into the bedrock as if it was soft, warm butter. The stream was so powerful, it could create that chasm. And what an experience it is for us to go there and to see the beauty of the first world and the wonder of the third world. Well, we explored North Lake and we began to notice there were two canyons up here where the arrows are. It was a teensy-weensy little problem. They had no water in them. How can you have a canyon without water? We knew we were onto something. We knew we had to investigate that. We galloped up the trail, the Blue Trail. We did. We galloped. We galloped. And we got there. Sure enough, it was dry, but it was vertical. We had found little red chasms perched way up in the Catskill front with vertical walls. The only thing that was missing was the stream, the raging, white water streams that should have been there and wasn't there. Where did the water come from and where did the water go? Well, the answer to that was when this formed, the Hudson Valley was still filled with ice. It rose right up to the top of the Catskill Mountain front, and that melting glacier formed a stream, just like Catterskill Creek, and then another one carving two canyons running down from the mountain to the front all the way to North Lake. And there was one of them. And there's another that we found later on, a little bit to the northeast of those two. Here's the moment of discovery. I got up here ahead of Johanna,
and our son Christopher, and I recognized what we were looking at, that we were in another one of these vertical walls, red chasm-like operations, and that the melting Hudson Valley Hudson Valley Glacier had created this canyon. And I took the picture within a minute of having made the discovery. The excitement, the thrill of discovery captured in the camera. Well, what a wonderful thing it is to understand, to comprehend, to be able to explain such a scenic place. Not just to admire it, not just to love the first world, but to let it transport you into the third world and to see it as it was when it formed. It is such a thrill. At the end of the Ice Age, there was one final advance of the ice. We went down to the bridge across the Hudson and walked out halfway and looked north and took this picture when it was still advancing down the Hudson Valley. And if you go there, you can look north and imagine this scene, which is pretty much the way it must have looked like. I bet most of you have been across the crossway down at Poughkeepsie. Got it?
Walkway.
Go there, get halfway across, look north, and put this picture into your eyes. That's what it looked like. That last advance was different. It created things that we don't see from the earlier advances. It has hills, Beckwith Hill. It's long north to south. It's very steep east and west. Gusky Hill, Unnamed Hill, Unnamed Hill. I think there's seven or eight of them here. This one's just as nice as they get. They're beautifully sculpted. They're hills composed of sediment, sand mostly, gravel, some cobbles. This is what they look like from the ground. There's no reason that you should have ever noticed such a hill. Ho-hum is just a little hill. They're called drumlins. They're Ice Age features. They were sculpted and deposited by the advance of the ice coming down for that one last time during the Ice Age, at the end of the Ice Age. Look at how many they are. This is where we live, over in Greenville. Drumlin. Look at that. There must be 100 of them in this air photo. And yet there's no reason why you should have ever noticed any of them. They're just so ho-hum. But they're hills, and there are a lot of them, and they speak to us of the movement of the ice. Over here, see that arrow? The glacier was going to the southwest. Here, the glacier was going north to south. You have to train your eye to see these things. So there they are. And in Columbia County, we found 130 of them. All of them oriented north to south. They're just part of our landscape. Well, one last final awful event at the Ice Age. At the very close, the Hudson Valley Glacier was vacating the Champlain Valley, and there was a great lake, Glacial Lake Iroquois, and Lake Champlain and Lake Albany. But there was something about to happen when the ice melts back just a little bit more. A flow of water will vacate Lake Iroquois and flow into Lake Champlain. A little trickle of water will become a flow of water, and then a powerful flow of water, and then it will melt its way through the rest of the ice, and there will be, for the next 80 days or so, one of the greatest floods that you could imagine anywhere. All of Lake Iroquois is going to drain through the Champlain Lowland and down the Hudson Valley and off into the Atlantic Ocean. To stand on the mountain house ledge on such a day and to watch the water flowing by at the bottom of the valley would have been breathtaking in every sense of the meaning of that word. Breathtaking. You probably could have heard the flow from way up there at the top of the mountains. What a thing to, in our mind's eye when we go there, we see this. What a thing to see. What a thing to appreciate. What a fabulous and horrible event this must have been. People have found boulders out here in the Atlantic Ocean, as big as cars, that came from the Adirondacks and were carried by that flood into the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. What an event it is. I get the last horrible catastrophe of the Ice Age, and we're going to go back to more benign things.
Are you?
We are. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You didn't tell them how big Lake Iroquois was.
5 times as big as all of the Great Lakes combined.
Mm-hmm. That flood also broke through the terminal moraine right at the area that we call today the Verrazano Narrows. And so it produced a drain or drainage area where all of that water from up here from Glacier Lake Albany and so on could drain that back down into the sea. Okay. So back to sediments. Let's talk about, what about sediments? Mud, right? Clay, big deal. Well, the sediments accumulated as the ice melted, waters receded, forests eventually grew back, and eventually even people came back, or came for the first time. And what did they do? They built brickyards and cement factories up and down both sides of the Hudson River. At their peak, using these Ice Age sediments, people up here built more than 1 billion bricks a year just for New York City. Why? New York City needed fire-resistant buildings. After 2 large fires in the middle of 1800s, destroyed a lot of the wooden structures in New York City, new codes were put up and they needed fire-resistant buildings. Those same sediments that built all those bricks, and these are my two favorite buildings that are built with Hudson River bricks in New York City that are still standing, and that's the Park Avenue Armory. Isn't it pretty? And this is a little subway station down by Wall Street, and it's built from Hudson River bricks. You can find more, you can even find mansions that are built from Hudson River bricks. But those are my two favorite. Those sediments that they built those bricks from, and there are really tons and tons and tons and tons of those sediments up and down the Hudson Valley, they can get very unstable. Especially when spring rains or snow melt saturate them. The Hudson Valley's long been known for its rotational slumps, as geologists call them. Landslides, as you know them. This is just from Troy. That's a picture from St. Peter's College, and you can see 1859. It wasn't even finished being built yet, and there was a landslide, and it was totally destroyed and never rebuilt. And since then, on that same hill, there have been 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 at least more landslides in that same place. People keep trying to build things on it, and we don't know why. Latest one was in 2011. But places where slopes occur, like delta fronts, or where streams have cut down through glacial lake sediments, are likely spots for these slides. And this one is in Del Mar, and not too long ago, it was the first one that we actually reported on. And you can see, we lost a bit of the road there. Nobody got hurt, nobody was injured, so that was good. And you can still actually go see the bottom of this today if you want. They made a little park with a path on the bottom. And this is over in Claverack, on the Claverack Creek, took a good portion of the parking lot of the Sons and Daughters of Italy Lodge with it down the creek. And Knickerbocker Cement Company in Hudson, Greenport actually, I think. Terrible slide, a couple of people were killed. The company was virtually ruined for a while. And this is the latest one. This is from last spring. And that's, on, again, on the Normanskill, like the Del Mar slide was. And that's a piece of Normanskill near Albany. They had to quickly react because it dammed the Normanskill when it collapsed into it. So they had to get equipment out there and reopen the Normanskill before it flooded the neighborhoods in the area. So you can see that all around here, there is a great landslide hazard. And if you look and if you plot the landslides, you'll see that they directly correspond to glacial lake sediments, especially the lake sediments of Glacial Lake Albany. So that's a little connection to the here and now from the Ice Age. And I guess we'd have to say no talk about the Ice Age would be complete about mentioning what's become the symbol of the Ice Age in New York. Dinosaurs, right? Dinosaurs died out 65 million years ago. Mastodons were alive up to about 10,000 years ago. And they are mammals, they are not dinosaurs. Yes. And so let's talk about the mastodon for a few minutes. This is the first prehistoric remains ever recovered in North America. And they were recovered in 1705 in Claverack, and that is a mastodon tooth. Up even to today, right, people are still fascinated by mastodons. The wise men of the area at the time, the governor especially, when this tooth was found, was convinced that it belonged to a biblical giant, and that those giants must still be roaming the area. Can you imagine being a new farmer to the area and thinking, oh no, there are giants here that have teeth like that? But they were corrected. Who were they corrected by? As the story goes, by a slave who had had encounters with elephants in his native land. Even the founding fathers were fascinated. Both George Washington and Thomas Jefferson had mastodon bones prominently displayed in their homes. And Jefferson was also sure, and in part sent Lewis and Clark out to the West because he was convinced that they would find a living mastodon for him. So let's get a little introduction to mastodons around here, and we'll talk more about Thomas Jefferson and why he was so interested in mastodons. At the end of the Ice Age, of course, all that meltwater had to come down the Hudson Valley. And we want you to think at the end of the Ice Age as just water everywhere. Very, 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 very wet. Swamps, glacial lakes, deep glacial lakes, shallow glacial lakes, big ones, small ones. Everywhere you looked, the water table was so high from all of this melting water. Thousands of feet of ice from here all the way back to Labrador had to melt. So for years, maybe hundreds, maybe thousands of years, it was very, very wet around here. Too wet, in fact, for a long, long time for forests to grow. But there was green around here everywhere. Where was it? It was water plants. It was green plants, algae, growing in the ponds and in the lakes. And then enter the mastodons. Okay? They had been down south. They can't live on top of a glacier. Okay? So as the glaciers advanced, they retreated. And as the glaciers retreated, they advanced north again. So they were following all these melting glaciers back up here. And they got back up to the Hudson Valley. And it was like paradise to them. It was getting warm, and they really had no mechanisms for cooling off. If you look at mastodons, they have little ears, right? Elephants have giant ears. They have giant ears because their blood vessels run through their ears, and as they flap their ears, they cool themselves. Well, mastodons didn't have that because they lived in an age when it was really cold. So when it started getting warm, they started overheating. And they came up to the Hudson Valley and they looked at these ponds and they went, holy crow, we must be in paradise. We got ponds to cool off in, and we've got plants in those ponds that we can munch on to our heart's content. So into the ponds they went. Trouble is, they never came out. All those ooey gooey sediments at the bottom of all those ponds and lakes stuck them like quicksand in those waters. And there they sat until we came along again to find them. To date, 101 mastodons have been found up and down the Hudson Valley. 100 of them stuck in the muck. Most of them have been found in Orange County in what was Glacial Lake Wallkill, very shallow glacial lake, now drained. And it's an area you might be familiar with. It's called today the Drownlands or the Black Dirt Region. And it's a very, very, very fertile region for growing things, especially people like to grow onions and pumpkins and things down there. And a lot of stands where you can buy wonderful, wonderful produce during the summer. Okay? And that's where most of them come from. So back to Thomas Jefferson. Right around the end of the Revolutionary War, Thomas Jefferson was in Paris. He went to Paris to try to establish trade agreements with the Europeans for the new United States of America. But it was at the same time as the leading European naturalist called Georges-Louis Leclerc published his 36-volume Natural History. In it, he wrote a section called his Theory of American Degeneracy. And he said, and I want to read you just a little part of this so you understand. He said, I quote, "In America, therefore, animated nature is weaker, less active, and more circumscribed in the variety of her productions. For we perceive from the enumeration of the American animals that the numbers of species is not only fewer, but that, in general, all the animals are much smaller than those of the old continent," meaning Europe. "No American animal can be compared with the elephant, the rhinoceros, the hippopotamus, the dromedary, camel, the camelopard, which was a giraffe, the buffalo, lion, etc. In the savage," meaning Native Americans, "the organs of generation are small and feeble. He has no hair. He has no beard. He has no ardor for the female. Though nimbler than the European, because more accustomed to running, his strength is not so great. His sensations are less acute, and yet he is more timid and cowardly. He has no vivacity, no activity of mind." Unquote.
Oh, okay.
That's a fighting words, huh? Well, this morphed into a general belief as people around Europe read these things that if a European male went to America, he'd better not stay too long because he too might begin to shrink. Well, say the least, Thomas Jefferson got a little upset. And he became obsessed with finding some symbol to counteract these claims. He needed something really big. He wrote to his friends, including Governor John Sullivan of New Hampshire, and got him to send him the carcass of the largest moose they could find. He had it stuffed and he had it mounted, and he plopped it right in the middle of his hotel lobby in Paris and said, "There. You think we don't have big animals?" Well, you know the French, right? Here's the French. That's what they thought of Thomas Jefferson. Well, he got back to the States, and he was looking for that symbol yet. And not only did it have to be large, but it also had to be fierce. He needed an American monster, right, to show up those French. So along with the American Philosophical Society, which was the leading scientific society in America at the time, still in existence, he sent Charles Wilson Peale, who you may know just as a painter, but he was also a naturalist, and they sent him. It was the first scientific expedition ever mounted in the United States. They even paid him $500. Good deal. And they said, go find us a mastodon. We need a mastodon. So he said, okay, and where did he go to? He went up to the Drowned Lands, up to Orange County. And by the time he was finished excavating, he had found enough remains to produce two complete mastodon skeletons. So he brought them back to Philadelphia, and he put them on display. First day was Christmas Day in 1801. And as they articulated, as they put these bones back together into a skeleton, they packed every joint they could possibly pack. They made this thing as large as they possibly could, and they deliberately mounted the tusks upside down. So now this poor veggie elephant looks like this fierce, horrible thing that's going to come and eat you. Right? So one of the two stayed in Philadelphia on display at the Philosophical Society. And the second one was sent out to tour Europe. And it did. It toured Europe for several years and wound up finally in a museum in Germany, where you can see the packing's been taken out and the tusks have been replaced in the right way. But he's still there today. They offered to send him back, but he's so delicate at this point that they're afraid any form of transportation would just turn his bones to powder. So there he stays in Germany. The most recent mastodon was found in the year 2000 in Hyde Park. Poor homeowner just wanted to do some landscaping around his pond in his yard when he found a bone. And so he started calling around to the different institutions. A lot of people just said, you know, you probably found a cow bone. We're not going to come all the way down there just to look at a cow bone. But an anthropology professor at Bard finally came down and took a look. Well, a team of students from several schools, including Vassar and Cornell, descended on his property, and it got a bit muddy. Oh. This guy is the most complete skeleton ever found. He's only missing a few toe bones. He was between 20 and 30 years old when he was when he died. About 7.5 tons, 9 feet high at the shoulder. And he met his end approximately 11,500 years ago. And he is cleaned up and on display at the Museum of the Earth in Ithaca, and he is known as the Hyde Park Mastodon. A complete mastodon, if you find one, is worth about $50,000. But it cost poor Mr. Lozier about $50,000 to put his backyard back together after they were done. So I can't promise you that you're going to make any money if you find a mastodon. Around here, there were several bones in the mid-1800s found in Greenville and Freehold, up by our house. And there are probably more bones at those sites today. People have just forgotten exactly where they are. And sometimes you have to dig down, maybe 30 feet, to find mastodons in the layer that they are in. But you never know. So if you're digging a hole in your backyard and you find something strange, just might be a mastodon. Well, thank you for listening, and we hope that you've enjoyed your journey with us. And we hope that from this day forward, you'll think of the Hudson Valley the way we do, as a gift of the Ice Age. And we'd be very glad to take any questions that you have. It's like...